Everybody needs a place. Pesach still needs a place for the Seder, or needs to sell their chametz or Bashak is available. But you should have whatever you need over Pesach. We the JSS Rebbeim do not take vacation. Okay, so whatever you need all throughout Pesach, please let us know. Here's the story. We're just gonna go through each of the Rebbeim, going through just a little bit of the Seder. We're sitting at a table here. We're all one big JSS family. And I think that's very that is not lost on all of us, how important you are to us. And if we could have it our way, I think we would all spend Seder together at a table like this. But Baruch Hashem, know that you're with us the whole time, and we'll miss you. Just real quick, and then I'll pass it on to Rabbi Orlian next. We're not going to go in the order of the Agada, but very quickly, just one thought that really underlies, I think, a lot of what we're talking about is at the Pesach Seder, you hold up the matzah, yeah? And you say, Halach ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction, oppression, right? This is poor man's bread. Mitzrayim, they ate in Egypt. So you should already, the whole night, you should be asking yourself questions. Did they eat the matzah in Egypt, or did they eat it when they left Egypt? They really left it when they left. They didn't eat in Egypt. So Rav Biederman, I think, brings down as a gadda. Listen very carefully, because this is a life lesson. Okay? Is actually they did eat in Mitzrayim. If you had to feed a slave cheap food, just give him crackers, like give him the cheapest food you can. Break bread, so they ate matzah there. And they ate matzah as they left. They actually ate the same food, because you know what freedom is? Freedom is a mental choice. It's in your mind. You can have the same exact matzah, but one day it's you were a slave food, and the next day you got it because you were rushed to leave, right? People say, if I only had $1 million, I would be the greatest guy in the world. No, if you had the same amount of money in your pocket, but you were happy with what you had, then you'd be free. If you won $1 million, you'd be a total slave. So that's a big lesson in life, is that it's our mindset. We should all go into the Seder with that, with a mindset of all this food, everything we're going to do tonight, I got to walk out of the Seder with a change mentally. How am I going to free myself mentally? That's one thought to share. When you hold up the matzah and you say, this is the bread that we ate in Mitzrayim, actually we did. It's really, could be the same exact thing, but you could be free and a slave all at once. I'm going to pass it to Rabbi Orlian. What do you
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to share with you something that has been passed down in my family. This is now five generations, the same exact thought. My great grandfather, blessed memory, who I never met, told this to his children, who told it to my mother, told it to us, we told it to our children, and I'm going to share it with you. Why is that important? It's because the single night that talks about legacy, that talks about tradition, that talks about carrying on what you got from your parents is the Seder night more than anything else. More than anything else, that's what the Seder night is about. Which is which on a side point, is sort of remarkable that we know what our great 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 grandparents had for dinner. How long ago? 3,500 years ago. I know exactly. What my great grandparents, what your great grandparents had for dinner 3,500 years ago on the night we left Egypt. They had matzah, and they had meat from the Pesach sacrifice, and they had marah, they had bitter herbs. We know exactly what they ate for dinner. It's pretty cool. They had shawarma 3,500 years ago on the night of the 15th day of Nisan, the night of the Seder night. And we're going to do the same. That's incredible. So, in the sense of tradition, I want to share with you this tradition that my family has, and I invite you to share with your families. There's a line in the Haggadah that talks about the four different types of children that a person has. A person could have a righteous child, a wise child, a person could have an evil child, a person could have an innocent, unintelligent child, different kinds of children, different kinds of people. We all know who are, the guy sitting next to you is the evil one, we're the righteous one. You know what I mean? There's one line there that's a little bit unusual. It says that how do we speak to our child who's a Rasha, our child who's a Rasha, who's evil. You picture the teenage kid coming home with his with his whatever he's dressed in, with his dreadlocks and his chains, walking into the Seder, not interested in anything else. So how do you talk to that kid? I have nothing against dreadlocks and chains. I'm just trying to give that image. What do you tell that kid? So the line of the Haggadah says the following. It says, when that evil son comes into your Seder, that Rasha, which is a strong word, evil, he's your son, and you recognize that he's an evil kid. He's bad. Like most mothers have a hard time thinking of their son as, my son is always sweet. He's always innocent. He could kill like 14 people with a machete, but he's such a sweet boy. That's just how mothers are. And here the Haggadah is telling us that a mother identifies, my son's evil. So you have to know how to talk to him as an evil kid. It says the following. Take him and blunt his teeth. Take your fist and put it in his mouth. Blunt his teeth. That's sort of what it's saying. Now, this is the message that my great-grandfather has shared for now 5 generations in our family. We know that in Hebrew, and I share this through our Torah every year at this JSS gathering, we know that in Hebrew, every letter has a numeric parallel. The word Aleph in Hebrew is 1. Bet is 2. So it says, take the Rasha and blunt his teeth. What's the gematria of Rasha? Resh is 200, Shin is 300, that's 500, and Ayin, the last letter, is 70. So it's 570. What happens if you take out from the word Rasha, 570, you take out the word Sheen of his teeth, which is 3, Sheen of, 366. What's 570 minus 366? You take the teeth out of someone who's evil. What's 570 minus 366? 204. Gentlemen, that's the numerical value of tzaddik. That's the numerical value of tzaddik. In other words, when the Haggadah says, knock out his teeth, blunt his teeth, what that really means, doesn't mean you take your son that you're not happy with and you go an upper left cut to the jaw. It means knock out his teeth, meaning make him a tzaddik. That's the lesson that I got from my great grandfather, who I never met. I invite you to share that to your great grandchildren.
From your great grandfather to our newest teacher. Who is coming back next semester? You would sign up, register for classes. Don't forget, right, Bosh?
Yeah. Conversation. I'll get the. This year for me, at least, I hope the Seder is going to be a fundamentally different experience than I've ever had. The themes we speak about the Seder, redemption, miracles, 10 plagues and splitting of the sea, and oppression, servitude, life-threatening stakes, at least in my lifetime, 28 years old, those themes have never been tangible for me living in America as they are right now today. I'm sure a lot of us have friends or family who are in the army in Israel. The people I've spoken to said what happened Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos, was nothing less than a revealed miracle. Someone compared it to 1967. This is the level of miracles we're seeing in our days. And the existential threat, people who would like each of one of us to be dead, we don't have to explain. These themes are alive. They're not historical anecdotes. They're not things that were relevant. They're things that, for the first time in my life, I'm experiencing. And there's a discussion in the Gemara as to where does the Seder start? Where do we start the story from? One opinion starts from the story of Egypt. Jewish people were enslaved. That's the beginning of the story. There's another opinion that says you start from the story of Lavan and Yaakov. The conflict, the disagreement that Lavan had with his son-in-law Yaakov, that's where the story of the Seder starts. Why do we start there? Just the idea I was thinking about this year is that the existential threat that we face on a physical level is clear. We know we can name the people who want us dead. We can name the enemies who have our head, the bullseye on their walls. We've seen it. We've seen the pictures. We've seen the attacks. But there's an equal, maybe even more dangerous threat, and that's an existential threat in ideology. That we're living in a time where there's this ideological opposition to Judaism. It's not new. It's always happened. And that ideological opposition to the Jewish belief is what Lavan represented. He wasn't looking to kill the Jewish people. He's looking to subdue their soul, subdue their ideals, their values. What we're seeing that's happening around us in America, on college campuses, everywhere we turn, it's not just people with erroneous beliefs. It's not people with bad ideologies. It's not people who have mistaken thoughts, values. They're an existential threat to our Jewish beliefs. And we walk into the Seder, and we sit down, and we think about the miracles that we're witnessing with our eyes for the first time in my lifetime. And we're thinking about the physical oppression that we're experiencing for the first time in my lifetime. It's also worthwhile to think about what are the ideals, what are the values, what are the perspectives, what are the truths that are also equally at odds with what's going on around us, what are the threats that we might not be so aware of, but may not be any less detrimental to our beliefs.
No. So we all know that some of you are the youngest in your family, and you might have to stand on a chair at the Seder and sing Manishtana. Anyone done that? Yeah, okay, good. Right, so the Manishtana, the four questions of the Seder. Now, those four questions are based on an idea which is explicit in the Torah, that the methodology of conveying the story of the Exodus is via question answer. Ki yishalcha bincha machar le'emor. When your son asks you, what's this about? Tell him this. There are four times in the Torah where you're speaking and responding to a question from someone. And Maimonides clearly states that ideally it should always be question answer. If you've got kids, they ask you the question. If there's no kids around, anyone asks. If it's a husband and wife together by themselves, wife asks the husband, husband asks the wife, whatever, right? If you're by yourself for Seder, which would be very sad, but even if you are, you ask yourself the question. So the obvious reason behind question answer is because it's a great educational technique, right? If you have a question and the answer is given to that resolves your question, that's automatically interesting because it bothered you. You had a question. But more than the educational technique, there's another aspect beyond that, which is that question is about darkness and the answer is light. And we know, as the verse says, the nation that dwelt in darkness, God was their light. You know, if you think about it, the Babylonian Talmud, which many of us are learning and which all of us benefit from, Babylonian Talmud was created in Babylon, the first exile of the Jews after over close to 1,000 years in Israel. Close to 1,000 years in Israel. We're in Babylon. And the Babylonian Talmud is basically what? Question, answer, refutation, question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. It's unbelievable work of intellectual prowess that is based on this idea of question answer. And the Talmud tells us that there's a verse that says, Ki nafalti kamti, which the normal translation of that is, even though I fell, I got up. The Talmud says, no, the correct translation is, because I fell, I got up. In other words, it was my failing, my lack of understanding, my darkness, that actually made me better in the end. What Tal ben Shachar calls not just resilience, but super resilience. You don't just spring back to where you were, you get better than where you were. Every time we have a question, it symbolizes the failure and the darkness, but that's a good thing because it means we're going to get better and we're going to improve and we're going to grow from the final answer. Rav Huttner once said that every exile is a one gigantic question mark. And every time God saves us, and God does a miracle, as Rav Orlian said, and God redeems us as he did from Egypt, and so on and so forth, every single time. Sorry, not Rav Orlian. Right, but all the rabbis blend together in my mind. But every time God saves us, it's an answer to that question of exile. Hence, the whole Seder is Q&A, question-answer, because it's a symbolic of failure and then greatness following the failure that's even better than you were before. Darkness, light followed by darkness followed by light, where the light's even more amazing when it's preceded by darkness, and the question following the answer, which is from an educational point of view, even better. So that's a little bit about why we do question and answer. Any questions? No? Nope. Pathetic. Okay.
Let me have a
I'm sorry, I can't really talk while I'm sitting down so well. Do I talk with my hands a lot? So a couple of years ago, in the middle of a Game of Thrones episode, there was a Starbucks coffee cup sitting in the middle of on the scene. And the internet went crazy. What's it going on? Is this like product placement? Is there a whole theory? Maybe this is an archaeological thing. What is going on with this coffee cup in this HBO show? And we found out later, oh yeah, one of the staff guys, they accidentally left it and they didn't realize it was on scene. We have a lot of cups on the table also on Pesach. On Pesach, we know we're very fond of the fact that we drink 4 cups of wine. All right, 4 cups of wine. How do we know there are 4 cups of wine? Does anybody know? Four cups is one bottle. Okay, yeah, I guess if you're the right size cup. 6 cups is a bottle of soda, by the way. It's 2 liters. 6 to 8 cups in a little plastic cups. Well, so the most famous answer is that when Moshe has an issue, God sent him to go save the Jewish people. And guess what happened? Pharaoh said, no. No, I will not let them go, if you know the song. No, I will not let them go. So Moshe goes back to God and says, I don't understand. I said, let them go. Pharaoh said, no. Not only that, add more work to it. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, God says to Moshe, don't worry. I'm going to make four, maybe five promises of redemption to you. I'm going to take you out. I'm going to redeem you. I'm going to make you a people. I'm going to bring you to the land of Israel. And I'll make you my nation. Four promises. So from here, the Gemara says, this is why we have four cups. Each one is a promise, and each one you'll drink to that. That's what we do. We'll drink to that. Each and every one. But there's a Game of Thrones coffee cup moment there as well. What do you mean? The Gemara, the Yerushalmi says, you know why? Because as it is, when we look at the story of Yosef serving in the house of, sorry, serving in the prison, and Paro's wine guy, we call it a butler, but he's a Saramashkim, he's like the wine guy. He's his wine connoisseur, he's the wine taster, make sure that nobody like substituted a 22 year for a 32 year. He's the guy. Nobody puts poison in the wine. He's the wine guy. He uses the word kos paro 4 times. What in the world? What's going on over here? Why do we care about paro's cup? Let me tell you a fantastic, fantastic idea. Unbelievable. The famous rabbi known as the Maharal of Prague, most famous for something he might not have done. They say he made a golem, like a Frankenstein monster. It's the monster that inspired Shelley's Frankenstein, actually. But one of the more magnificent things that he did, he wrote 17 books of Jewish thought, which are fantastic. One place, at the end of the Yaakov story, end of the Yosef story, we know Yosef sold his slave. Yaakov doesn't know where he is. And Yosef says ultimately to his brothers, his father, look, there's been a big plan going on over here the entire time. We just didn't see it. It's like four parshios in the Torah. It's a long plan. It's, as we call it nowadays, the long game. Right? There's a long game going on. So he says this over and over, and he also signaled this. We have a thing in media, we call it signaling. I want to tell you something about me. I'm signaling in different ways. He signals this to his father. How does he do it? He sends his father 10 donkeys, 10 donkeys loaded with bottles of old wine. 10 donkeys loaded with bottles of wine. So the thing about a donkey is that it doesn't know what it's doing. It's just carrying a load and moving things along. The 10 donkeys are the 10 brothers who they thought they were selling Yosef into slavery. They didn't realize they are part of this much bigger game. They are actors in a much, much bigger play. They are carrying this. And why the wine? Because the wine represents the decree that God's going to take the Jews out of Egypt. Even as they're going down to Egypt, there's part of this long plan. So when we drink the wine, so Maharal says, what's that wine? That's the wine of the 4 cups of Pesach. The wine that Yosef sends his father is this is going to, we're going to make a Seder, and there's going to be 4 cups of wine, and we're going to celebrate. Right now, we're all moving down to Egypt, not the best move. We're moving down to Egypt. There's going to be slavery. It's going to be hard, but we're going to get out of this, and there's going to be 4 cups of wine. And the same way we drink 4 cups of wine, also as remembering that, but also looking into the future. Because God promises that it's going to happen. It happened once, and it's going to happen again. So every time we drink a cup of wine, it's not just, it's not just we're drinking wine. It's not just because the wine seller's got to make some money, but also there's something freeing about drinking wine. It's to say, look, there is an ability to rise over your current circumstance. You can be inebriated with freedom, not just inebriated, it's not like Purim, drink a whole bottle of something. It's 4 cups of wine. 4 cups of wine means be a little freer. Think a little bigger. The circumstance, you can rise above it. That's what the 4 cups of wine indicate to us. These 4 cups of wine to give us a passion. Everything that we're saying is true. And after we say L'chaim, it intoxicates us a little bit more. How
about you? It's being recorded.
Yes.
Pause it.
I should pause it.
What's your line?
Yeah, not that.
Can't afford to get canceled this week.
Okay, first of all, I don't mind if I'm recorded. Number two, I'll try not to be as complicated as just or a little bit. I'd like to talk about the apikoman. All right, so that means we're getting towards the end of the Seder. All right, at the end of the meal. That is your dessert. But let's understand what the Afikoman is. The Afikoman is today, number one, the replacement for the Paschal lamb, the Korban Pesach, which was a lamb or a sheep, that the Torah says that was your dessert. So, I'm going to tell you, first of all, something very interesting. We know that, please God, next coming Monday night, there are only two special biblical mitzvahs. The whole night, just two biblical mitzvahs that are special to us. To tell the story of the Exodus, as we heard before, two different places where we start, etc. But the second one is to eat matzah. Now, I'm going to ask everybody a very simple question. When do you fulfill the mitzvah of matzah? Do you fulfill the mitzvah of matzah at the very beginning of this meal, when the first thing you're going to eat is motzi matzah? You're going to make the bracha motzi lechem min haaretz. This is our bread this coming Monday night, and you're going to eat a piece of matzah leaning to your left. Is that your mitzvah of matzah? What do you say? Good. You are following the opinion of the Rush. A very great Talmudic commentator, and you're following his opinion. Guess what? Rashi says you have no choice but to eat a piece of bread now. You're starting your meal. The meal has to start with bread. You can't eat regular bread, so tonight's bread is matzah. So hold on. According to Rashi, when am I fulfilling my mitzvah of matzah? According to Rashi, you're fulfilling your mitzvah of matzah when you eat your afikoman. Why? Because the afikoman, I told you before, reminds us of the what? Of the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach, the Paschal lamb, was eaten for dessert. How was it eaten? It was eaten, as we know, al matzos umarorim yochluhu. It was eaten together with matzah and maror. So therefore, your matzah really is the matzah at the end of the meal. Okay, why am I telling you this? Most of us, when it comes to the time of the Afikoman, we are full. Let's be honest. Save space for it, guys, because really, if you get a small piece of the Afikoman, and you don't have to get a piece of the actual middle matzah, the bigger piece that was saved, no, a piece of matzah. But don't take a little piece of Afikoman. You need a big piece. If you're using a machine, matzah, machine shmura matzah, you're talking about a half of that. He's talking about a round shmura matzah, talking about approximately a third. Okay, so I'm telling you, the first thing is you're ready to eat a nice sized piece of matzah. Okay, one beautiful thought. Watch. Rabbi Orlean, hurry up, hurry up. What time do you have to finish eating Yapikoma?
Midnight, which is 12:15.
Four. Okay, good. So you have to finish the Afikoman by mid the night, approximately 12:55 this year in the New York area.
Sorry, why is it not
12? Well, first of all, why is it not 12? That's a technical thing that the night is divided into 12 equal parts. The day is, etc. So that's called Shabbos Zmani.
I was here between sunset and sunrise.
Okay, now, watch. A very interesting idea. Why do we have to finish, really, according to the Ramah, not just have the matzah, the afikoman, by mid the night? You should finish your four cups. You should finish the halil, according to the Ramah. Everything has to be finished, all the eating, drinking, by mid the night. Very strange. What's happening here? Gentlemen, hold on. Beautiful, beautiful thought. Let's go back to the first Seder in Egypt. We know what they ate, thanks to Rabbi Orlean. The key thing is, what were they celebrating on that night? The night of the first Pesach Seder in Jewish history. What were they celebrating? Come on. They were not yet celebrating freedom. When did they get free? They didn't get free till mid the night. Torah says, it was at mid the night. Whoa, that's when all the action happened. Hashem yikoh kol b'chor. God killed out all the firstborn. Now, Pharaoh gets up and says, get out. Get out. Oh, now I'm free. So what should we do? Rabbi Lerner, listen to me. Next Monday night, go to shul. Come home. Take a long nap for 3 hours. Tell them to wake you at 12:30. You're going to get dressed. Put on your tuxedo at 12:30. Ready to go. Wash your face. I'm starting my Seder. Because why? At 12:54, we are exactly celebrating what happened, that God killed them out. Now we're free. No. What did they celebrate in Mitzrayim before 12:54? 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock. What are you celebrating? They celebrated one concept, Emunah. They celebrated belief that God will do it. And guess what, my friends? This coming Monday night, we're not just remembering how he, capital H, took us out of Egypt, but was celebrating Emunah, that just as he took us out of Egypt, so he will extricate, take us out of the exile that we are in now. Please, God, when we say Lashana Haba, Yerushalayim, if not before, we mean it, because we have faith. If you didn't have faith till this past Saturday night, you have faith. And this faith is going to keep us going, that he will extricate. Yes, my friend.
First of all, great. Second of all, my question is, only 20% of the Jews left, so not all the Jews were celebrating Emunah.
No, you're right. Those who left celebrated before they left Emunah. In other words, this, what am I celebrating? That God will kill the firstborn. God will take us out. Wow. Because think about it. Every other celebration that you go to is something that happened. The other day I had a bris, the baby was. A bar mitzvah, he now is. A wedding, he put the ring on her finger. Every other celebration, except for the Pesach Seder, was celebrating something that will happen. Celebrating a moon.
That's wonderful.
A wonderful Pesach.
Have you done it? Are you guys serious?
We're going to keep this very quick.
Okay.
There are two moments in a Jew's life when we recommit ourselves and commit ourselves to our people. At a bris is when an individual Jew builds a relationship with God. The Seder night is a night annually when we recommit ourselves to our people. We're going to read in the Haggadah, B'shivim nefesh, Yardu avoseinu l'mitzrayim, 70 souls Our ancestors went down to Egypt. But it doesn't say 70 souls. It says Shivim Nefesh in the singular. Because we're all one soul. If October 7th taught us anything, it's that we're all one people. I've had the privilege now of teaching here 15 years and being at 15 of these seders. I've never seen Rabbi Yudin look like that before in 15 years. And why does he look like that? Because since October 7th, he hasn't shaved or trimmed. Because we're one family. And when one person, our family's hurt, we all hurt. And when one person celebrates, we all celebrate. You know, I happened to have been in Israel on October 7th. And we were staying on a street called Shiftei Yisrael in Yerushalayim. And it was the first day of Simchas Torah. And on the little street, there's a little makolet. A little, like, corner cafe, I don't know what you call it. Little tiny grocery store. The people buy milk and eggs. And Pesach, Sukkot ended. And normally the makolet opens up at night. And people ran to the makolet. And all of a sudden there was a sign on the makolet door that said, Slicha Sagur, Halachti li lachem. I went to fight. But if you have any real issues, he gave a phone number, call my wife. The next morning, which was the second day of Yom Tov for us, with the sirens going, we're walking to shul. One block away, you couldn't go further. And we passed by this little makolet. And outside the makolet, the milk has been delivered. Just like you see in places, every bodega around here in the middle of the night, they come and they deliver the milk, they deliver the bread, they deliver everything that's being sold on a daily basis. And we went to daven very early because we weren't sure. And it's 6:30 in the morning, still basically dark. And the poor wife of this makolet owner is standing there besides herself. It was her father-in-law's business before her husband's. Her husband's runs it. They don't have any children at home. Her husband's gone to the front. Her children are in the front. She doesn't know what to do. Within 5 minutes, all of a sudden, all these little angels from the neighborhood came. Little kids, I'm talking 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds. And they said, Giveret, anachnu yicholim lazor, can we help you? And we just sat there and watched 6, 7, and 8 year olds put all the bread on the shelves, take all those dripping packets of milk, and put them in the place where they need to be. And no one wanted anything in return. Well, you know what, my friends? Her husband was in war for 50 days. And we got to know someone who lived on that street. Until her husband came home. 50 days later, the kids of the neighborhood volunteered every morning to come before they went to school to pack everything and put it into the shelves of the makolet. We're one family. We might be at times a highly dysfunctional family, but we are one mishpacha. We're one family. And Pesach reminds us that we're one family. I shared with some of you the other night that I remember when I first came to America with my late father, Oliver Sholem, in 1977, we happened to be here for Pesach. Then Soviet Jewry was at its height, and most American families left a chair at their table that was empty to remember the Jews in the Soviet Union that were refuseniks. In the 80s, there were people that left a chair empty at their table because of the Ethiopian Jews that were stranded in Gondar. But most of us, including my children or your age, have never, ever grown up with the reality of an empty seat at the Seder table. This is the first year that all of a sudden many people are going to reintroduce that empty seat at the Seder table. Because there are over 1,000 families. They're going to look around at the table and someone's not there who wasn't there last year and didn't just die a natural death. And another 133 families, they're going to look around and see that empty chair and not know where their son or daughter is. So I want to ask you one favor. The rabbi spoke about different reasons. Rabbi Bashnik said beautifully about four different reasons why we drink four cups of wine. The rabbi suggests there's another reason. And that is, it says, Arba tzrichim lahodot. There are four situations in life where you have to give thanks. One of them, and those are the four times in life that we bench Gomel, we say the special bracha of thanksgiving, thanking God for having removed us from a perilous situation. So the rabbis tell us, what are those four situations? One is a Yordei Hayam, someone who traversed the sea and successfully came out of the sea. The other is the Ovrei Midbarios, someone who passed over the mountains, the deserts, and successfully came out of their journey. The third one is a Chole Sheitrape, a sick person who became healed. When we came out of Egypt, we traversed the sea and we succeeded. That's one cup. We crossed the deserts and we succeeded. That's another cup. When we got to Mount Sinai, anyone who was sick was miraculously healed. That's a third cup. And the fourth time you have to make that blessing of Hagomel is when a person was imprisoned and they were released. The person was in captivity. They were kidnapped and they were released. When we as a people for 210 years were in slavery in Egypt, it was like we were all kidnapped. And so with one of those cups of wine, what we're also celebrating is the fact that we got out of freedom. So I want to ask you all one favor. And that is, when you drink those four cups of wine, let's think about the fact that not only in the ancient times did we come out of Egypt, did we cross the sea where we healed, but we also got out of captivity. And as we drink each four of the four cups, you can think about all the reasons. Whether it's the four cups from Pharaoh's dream or the four languages of redemption, but as you drink each one of the four cups, make a special l'chaim and have a special intention that just like our ancestors came out of Egypt and out of slavery, that the 133 hostages should come out of slavery and all those hundreds of bodies that their parents haven't been able to achieve closure with their death, that they should also come out of captivity. And just remember one thing, friends. There's only one line you'll hear from me over and over and over again. And that is, what does the word l'chaim mean? Right? It doesn't mean to life. Because Jews never talk about life in the singular. Chaim means life. Chaim means lives. Because when we make a toast, or when we drink l'chaim, it's not just to life. It's to lives. Because my life without your life is no life. If Rabbi Yudin has a beard, it's because he understands that nobody else, he can't really celebrate when there are other people in pain. You know, this past 3 weeks ago was my son's Ufruf. We happened to be in New Square. And someone asked, how's the Rebbe reacted to the kidnapping of the 133. And they said, you really want to know? Someone asked the mayor. No one knew this. He said, since October 7th, except for on Shabbos, the rabbi hasn't eaten any hot food or drunk anything that's hot. Because we're one family. And he didn't want to give himself that sense of relief.